Broadcasting from a secret government site while we collect all your data, it's the Funk Zone Podcast with your host, Ted Mills.
Hello, 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 folks. Welcome to the Funk Zone Podcast. This is episode 96. I am your host, Ted Mills. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sitting down, taking a weight off. This is the show where I interview artists and creative people, and I try to find out why they do what they do. Saul Hill is back on the show today for Volume 2, Part 2, the sequel of our conversation. We talked so much last week about his photography that we barely got into his new installation work and other matters I wanted to talk about. So I asked for a second interview, and I got one, and now you have this. We dive deep into our world's current obsession with surveillance and secrecy and how it relates to his art. And then we also end on a state of the arts in Santa Barbara kind of discussion. So stay around for that. Is an entertaining hour and a bit. Man, I enjoy talking to Saul about this. I'm glad I could keep up. It's really what I wanted to say. Just like last week, you can find him on the web at SaulHill.com, S-O-L-H-I-L-L. And on Twitter at Saul Hill, same thing, S-O-L-H-I-L-L. And the show that we start talking about, the one, his group show that he's putting on, that opens this Friday at his gallery. What would that be? Friday the 30th, I guess, right? Wait, hold on. 29th. Oh, no, sorry, 28th. October 28th. Wow, man, I really should have researched that. Okay. It opens this Friday, the 28th of October, 2016, at his gallery, 111C Santa Barbara Street. The show is called This Time is Political and features political art, you guessed it, by several Funk Zone artists like Sue Van Horsten and Dan Levin and Saul Hill himself and several others I have yet to meet. But hey, maybe there'll be future guests on the Funk Zone podcast. So get thee hence, my friends, Friday night for that. And now, at last, I can announce the tickets are on sale for the 100th Funk Zone Podcast episode live. Oh my god, extravaganza, SB cast, and you, my friends, are invited. The date is Friday, November 18th from 6 to 9 p.m., and I will be hosting a very special talk show format episode with very special guests, music, food, drink, and much more. And part of the proceeds go to one of my favorite nonprofits in town, the very, very wonderful Slingshot, which gives developmentally disabled artists space and the material to create some really amazing stuff. I've toured their space. I'm incredibly jealous of the amazing studio in which they get to work. There's drawing tables, and there's the ability to sculpt, and there's a kiln. I think that's off-site, but there's a kiln-like thing there, and there's so much more, and and the stuff they produce is absolutely amazing. And because I think it's amazing, we're not just having them on as a partner. We're going to have a gallery up of their work for you to check out and to purchase. There will also be a silent auction of other cool things to bid on, whether that's art or drinks or special things around Santa Barbara. I don't know what they're going to be yet. Don't want to say it yet. Okay. Here's the thing. This is the reason I'm doing this. I've been making this podcast, as you know, fans, for 2 years, and been making that for the most part completely by myself and for free. You don't hear me do ads in the front. Maybe you'd like me to do ads. I don't know. But I don't do ads at the front. It's just me starting the episode and ending the episode. So your ticket and your donations will help me take this show into the future to year 3 and beyond and to the next level, whatever that's going to be. I'd love it if I could have 2 shows a week. You know, I could go on tour and interview artists all over the county and maybe even beyond. Who knows? So go over to, here's the website, go over to www.funkzonepodcast100, that's 100, funkzonepodcast100.eventbrite. For those who don't know, Eventbrite is E-V-E-N-T-B-R-I-T-E.com. One more time, funkzonepodcast100.eventbrite.com to buy tickets. So, of course, you can just go to our page and click on the link. They are $20 general, $100 VIP tickets. General tickets get you your first drink for free, but VIP tickets get you food and drink for free that night, as well as a goodie bag full of stuff from the Funk Zone podcast and Slingshot. And hey, if you want to support the event but you can't make it that day, as I know people are busy out of town, there's also a spot on the Eventbrite page so you can just donate. Isn't that nice? Oh yes. Hey, but maybe you're a subscriber to the mailing list. If you are, mailing list subscribers, you get a deal. You get 10% off your order, but you only know what that promo code will be if you are part of the mailing list. Oh, that's right. Okay, so you should have an email, or you're soon to get an email about that mailing list, people, to find out what that code is. So type in the code, you're going to get $10 off, 10% off your order. Okay, talk about that. If you're liking the show, you really should consider joining the mailing list over at funkzonepodcast.com. I just told you why. Otherwise, you also get to hear about the new shows first. You hear about special deals in the store. And every Friday, mailing list subscribers get an email with 10 links to art, videos, cool writings, and such, which apparently everybody goes nutty for, and I'm glad to do it. Just a little thing. I like to keep you updated with cool stuff. That's really it. That's all I send you. So, in the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter at Ted Mills, and you can like me on Facebook at The Funk Zone Podcast, and subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave a rating, folks. That helps us out a lot here in Funk Zone Podcast land. Whew. You can also show your support by pledging as little as a dollar a podcast over at our page at patreon.com/funkzonepodcast. That's $4 a month, at least. What a deal. Can you afford it? Thank you. Okay. All right, folks. Let's get this interview going with Sol Hill. Sol Hill Part 2. Sol Hill 2 Electric Boogaloo. Sol Hill 2 Behind Enemy Lines. All those sequels. This is better than all those sequels. Sol Hill Volume 2. Recorded October 25th, 2016. At his Funk Zone studio. And now ready for you and your alternative no government interference ears. Here we go.
Okay, Sol Hill, welcome back.
Part two.
Part two, indeed.
Part two of the Funk Zone Podcast interview with you. I returned to your studio.
Always here. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. Down here in the Funk Zone, And let me just take these off and we will continue. Now that sound seems doable, let's pick up where we left off. Because we started to talk about this work, which is now facing us, which is this political work. But let's talk about the political show that's coming up.
So first,
or that's
thing,
already started, right?
Well, no, I'm hanging it this week, and the opening is this Friday.
What's the date?
Ignore that poster.
Oh, okay. That's what I was thinking. Mistake. I missed so it. Oh, that's a mistake. Not the
this Friday.
The 29th,
is that right?
We're looking at our phones.
Because nobody can remember anything about those phones
today,
anymore.
So, 28th, Friday the 28th.
Friday the 28th, yes, 5 to 7:30.
What's the show called?
The name of the show is This Time It's Political.
Yeah.
An irreverent art show with artists speaking out.
Yep.
And try as I might to get perspectives from, you know, all sides of the spectrum. This being Santa Barbara, it was a little bit, you know, shifted one side.
Yeah.
But still, we've got some great pieces that talk about issues and about, you know, a couple of the candidates, you know, critical of both sides, which is kind of what I wanted to see, some dialogue within the arts about, you know, current state of affairs and politics, yeah, in our country.
I mean, liberal conservative, you can always go after the man.
Yeah, yeah. There's always somebody to rant about. But what I found so interesting with this insane election year is how you really had candidates on the far ends of the spectrum with these incredibly strong showing, you know?
Yeah.
That really this was sort of in the most paradoxical way, it was like the complete outsider political process that kind of has almost focused, you know, the guarantee on the absolute insider you know, as the person to beat. So, you know, Hillary being the sort of astute, you know, studied, experienced political insider, versus Sanders and Trump, you know, and I think the sentiment for Sanders and Trump, you know, is coming from a very similar place, but from very different, parts of the country. And I wouldn't say red state, blue state. I would simply say urban and rural. You know, that's really the divide that's going down in this country. And it's a cultural thing. It's this culture of, there's a great article I was reading. I wish I could name the author, but it was basically breaking it down as, you know, it's sort of a culture war that's going on in our country right now. And it has more to do with, you know, urban values and rural values. Mm-hmm. And the way I see it is, in rural areas, you know, they're much more close-knit societies. You know your neighbors. You know, there's not a lot of others around, you know. Mm-hmm. There might be, you know, migrant workers out in the fields, and there might be folk of a different color living on the other side of the street or the tracks, but people don't really mix much, and there's not a lot of outside ideas. People tend to stay more with their tribe, their group.
Yeah.
And in urban areas, everything gets mashed up. So there's a lot of ideas that, you know, get spread. And then culture sort of emanates from the urban areas where you have, you know, all your popular music and not all. I mean, there's quite a strong country music, you know, tradition. Yeah. But
those come from the cities within, you know, like Nashville. And
certain areas. Yeah. And then, you know, movies and television sort of emanate out of urban areas, and so it's sort of, I think of it more as, you know, how much exposure do you have to, you know, a wide variety of ideas versus how much are you like in your, you know, sort of cultural paradigm and you see anything else coming in as a threat. And that happens, and I'm not trying to make a judgment, and I really don't want to say that, you know, rural people are ignorant. I think urban people can be just as ignorant of things that are really important, like, you know, the value of farming, the value of, you know, the earth and stuff like that. But I do think that to a certain degree in modern America, even that most fundamental rural value is being usurped by large agribusiness, you know, sort of a corporatization of things that bothers me the most. So if I go talking about politics, I'll very often get into political economy. Yeah.
Then we'll get into episode 3 or volume 3 of this episode.
Possibly.
Yeah.
But anyways, you were asking about this piece that we're looking at over here.
Oh,
which...
yeah, but before that,
okay.
I mentioned the artists are going to be in the show. We just want to give a shout out to who's in the show before we move on.
We have in the show, we've got Dan Levin and Sue Van Hortsen, Perry Hoffman, Colleen Kelly, Dougie Wallace, myself, David Mark Lane, Lawrence Wallen, Quentin G., Charles Waldron, and Jim Mechanic, and Charles Starr.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a...
That's a nice-sized
group.
Nice group.
A good, you know, sort of diversity of artistic approaches and, you know, some great pieces that, you know, discuss sort of a couple of them, the candidates, but quite a few of them are more sort of, you know, the issues that have been flying around, examined one way or another.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it should be fun.
Yeah.
My first curated show here in the Funk Zone art space.
Oh, awesome. And when's it going to run till?
Through November 14th, through the week of the election.
So we should know by then.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So we can
It would be fun to come, you know, and see the work prior to the outcome and then come back and look at it with...
new eyes.
New eyes.
New bloodshot. Bleary eyes.
Right, jittery eyes.
But what's interesting about the new work is this is really, well, maybe you'll make the connection, but this seems so far removed from your metagraphs.
Right. Well, it is visually and topically very far removed, but I think from my sort of metaphysical impulses as an artist, I see a connection in that what I ultimately want to do with my art is to shed light into the world for people to have some, you know, sense of new understanding. And, you know, as an artist, I just feel like I'm a flashlight. trying to shine something, you know, illuminate something that people haven't really thought of before, or, you know, and in one side, I think the metagraphs sort of speak more to that sense of wonder and mystery about the nature of reality, about our place in it, about spirit, you know, and how we respond in terms visually and emotionally to archetypes. And this work over here, it's really more sort of the installation projects that I've been developing started with this one. And this project is called Suspicious Privacy. Mm-hmm. And it is an installation that examines surveillance and privacy in sort of the digital contemporary age. Mm-hmm. And it really started as sort of a photographic study of a government document that was released. And at the time, I wasn't sure if it was released openly or just leaked. But basically, I came across it from a post on an online, you know, news site that I have as a homepage. And it was basically saying, these are words you cannot say online. Mm. And there were some very innocuous words like smart or help or wave or pork.
Pork.
And I just looked at this like, what do you mean you can't say these? So I went and I read the article. It was very short, but it had a link to a privacy advocacy site, which then had some more detailed information and a link to the article, to the document, which was called the Analyst Desktop Binder 2011. And it was basically...
That's sexy.
Very sexy. But it was a document that outlined the protocols around electronic surveillance, mm-hmm. Presumably for, I mean, Department of Homeland Security agents, but presumably NSA. There are parts that were redacted. And it just spells out essentially that there's this list of hot keywords that are scanned by our government on any electronic communication. So be it an email or a text message or a blog entry or, you know, any written electronic communication, that algorithmically then triggers the need for a live analyst to go look at the work or to look at the communication.
Yeah.
And so they're individual hot keywords. And in the list, a lot of them make sense. Like there was one that was worm, you know, and
could be a hacker, a worm. Hmm? Could be a hacker. Talk about
right. Yeah. In that case, it would be talking about, you know, internet viruses, worms, Trojan horses, hackers, and stuff like that. But just as an individual keyword, if you're talking about your worm box, or, you know, I finally got like my garden, you know, soil full of worms, and there's just so many different ways that an individual keyword will get triggered.
What if I'm saying, I don't feel very smart, I need help with this pork for dinner? Then I'd be on that list.
The pork one, I still couldn't exactly figure out why that was a trigger. You know, the section it was in seemed to have not much relevance. Maybe it was political pork, or I'm not entirely sure what that was about, but and some of them too, like help.
Yeah.
As a trigger word. And, you know, the document basically just sort of outlined these protocols around, you know, having this electronic surveillance with automated keywords, and then needing a live analyst, you know, just sort of quick attention to see if it's something that needed further scrutiny. But I did this right before, you know, the revelation of Edward Snowden. Mm-hmm. And I was so, like, worried that, you know, I didn't want to download the document. I was so dumbfounded by this document that I thought I needed to do something artistically with it. I didn't know what it was, but I was too paranoid to download the document.
Yeah.
And so...
Quite rightly so.
Right. Well, I was already thinking, man, I'm probably being tracked just having gone and seen it online.
Yeah.
And so I decided to start to photograph elements of the document that gave some context to what it was, and then parts of the keyword lists. With my camera, just to get records of, instead of downloading the document or doing screen grabs. Mm. So then it was sort of an off-site record, so to speak, in my camera. But a great thing happened. I work with digital artifacts, right, with my metagraphs. And When you point a digital sensor towards a digital monitor, you get all kinds of crazy interference patterns. And so I started to intentionally work to get, you know, just these wild interference patterns. I got my macro lens out to photograph, you know, really close individual keywords and get the, you know, the digital sort of screen level pixel pattern, red, yeah, green, blue pixel pattern of the screen. Then I would angle it to pick up the interference patterns. And I played with as many, and I used digital noise in some of them just to acquire as many sort of digital artifacts as I could, because I figured that then speaks to the fact that this is really a digital, you know, the issue of privacy and surveillance online is a digital subject. And so I was using all the artifacting I could generate from digital interference to point towards that, artistically, just visually speaking. And then I had this sort of selection of images that had some components to give context of this document, but mostly it was these keywords. And for the most part, I chose words to focus on that were innocuous or so widely, you know, interpretable that it was like almost absurd. Mm-hmm. But then I would throw in some like attack, you know, or deaths, you know, just because there is a reason why the government is doing this. Yeah, there are bad people out there. You know, it's just the question I have is, to what degree are we comfortable with, you know, our lives being entirely traced, tracked, recorded? And where does our privacy, at what point do we want to insert and assert our right to privacy? Mm-hmm. And so I had the great fortune of meeting a curator from Santa Fe, New Mexico named Craig Anderson, who was very excited by this project and suggested that, you know, it was sort of one-dimensional as a photographic project presented as just still images, that, you know, the issue and the topic and the ideas I were talking about were so much deeper that it would be great to develop it as an installation concept and, you know, make it an experience for the viewers. And so then I started thinking about, and I had never really done installation art. It was something that was always a bit of a mystery to me. I didn't understand the economics of it. And I got a great education on the process of developing and moving installation projects out, thanks to Craig. And he really helped me sort of think in this dimensional sense of how do you make an experience with an installation. And my main goal was to think about surveillance and privacy, which are sort of remote concepts, you know, they're not something we experience emotionally. So, you know, and we tend, it's an uncomfortable one too. So people will think about it and they'll say, oh yeah, you know, that's really important, and then move on because they're not having an emotional relationship with it. So my whole goal was, how do I create, you know, an installation to force the viewer to have an emotional reaction to the ideas of surveillance and privacy? And so the idea is I created a series of physical artworks that are, you know, the installation and the piece over here that you would reference, these light boxes.
Yes. It's a huge light box, by the way, for people who are not.
Yeah, they're four panels of black light boxes, black framed light boxes.
So there's two more that we can't see.
Right. They're just not up because I didn't have the height, the space there, or the width in this particular spot.
Okay.
And they're backlit, and on the face is 111 or 110 pages of two documents that the U.S. government released when they were sued by the ACLU under the Freedom of Information Act to that are basically spelling out the government's policy on GPS surveillance. And here I am picking up my iPhone.
Yeah.
Any cell phone these days, any smartphone, any car that has, you know, mapping options, any device that is GPS enabled, the government tracks its location through time and geography. So they have a historical geographical trail of, you know, essentially where all these devices have been. And if they're associated with you, it's a, you know, approximation of saying, where have you been and when were you there?
Yeah.
And so that's like for everybody who has a GPS-enabled device, which are so ubiquitous now, it's almost to say everybody. And so the ACLU thought that was rather a lot of, you know, very kind of sensitive, potentially sensitive information that the government is gathering. So, you know, that it would be the American people should have a right to know what they're doing with it, with a little bit more specificity. And so they sued under the Freedom of Information Act, which obligates the government to release the documents, but they also have the right to redact anything that they deem would cause danger to anybody, you know, cause a danger to an operative or to an individual. But in this case, they redacted 108 pages entirely of the 111 released. And then the remaining few pages are like partially redacted. I think there were only two pages that were untouched. So basically what you have is a black rectangle taking up almost the entirety of the page with the white margins of around the perimeter at the bottom, a page number, and at the top right corner, some annotation of probably the releasing officer.
They're just slightly different colors of gray.
Yeah, well, that's because they're photocopies.
Shades of gray, I guess.
Yeah,
right, yeah.
Kind of shades of gray and black.
No pun there for that show, or that movie.
And so it was, you know, essentially, you get nothing.
Yes.
And it had to be a light box because, you know, I wanted this play between light, the force that illuminates, you know, the idea of illumination, which is knowledge and information versus this redaction, you know, blackness. And in this case, there's no amount of light you throw at it reveals anything.
Yeah.
And so the piece is called Freedom of Information. And I have some other pieces, you know, that most of those photographs that I put together create a photo mural, which is a 12-foot by 18-foot mural that assembles in a grid on the wall of all the keywords that algorithmically trigger a live analyst's need for attention. Mm-hmm. And then I have some other, you know, of the document giving some context of that document. I have another lightbox triptych, which is a redacted outline of the changes to electronic surveillance that were done through FISA under the Bush administration. And the reason I chose it is the last panel. So the last panel of that piece has what I would consider possibly the most creepy government clip art I have ever seen. And just when you think, like, you know, of weird job descriptions, like somebody actually had to draw this image, you know, and somebody had to choose it to put in this document. But it's sort of an outline of the various changes to electronic surveillance. And the last panel is a box that says, the header says questions with a question mark. Questions? And the clip art, the rest of that box is this clip art, which is two hands reaching up through like a dungeon grate in the floor with a huge padlock on the side, just reaching up like... Like, so as if to imply, if you have questions, you're going here.
You're going in the pit.
You're disappearing.
Wow.
And so I made that triptych into a oversized lightbox, blew up the pages to, you know, 36 inches or something and made it a triptych lightbox. And it wasn't quite enough. You know, the last panel, I wanted to make sure people really focused on that last panel. So I splashed it with sort of blood red paint and thinned out so it's like stained. And then took my two hands with you know, the paint and just put two sort of aboriginal hand marks there, you know, because hands are such a symbol of affirmation of life. And then there's the two hands reaching up in the, you know, in the grate. And so yeah, that was one piece. I have several pieces. One piece that I still need to complete. Other than that, almost all the physical artwork for the show is done.
Is this all going to Santa Fe?
This is, well, right now I'm looking for an initial home for this. But once I have raised the funds that I know, you know, I can physically complete the installation and I can provide the cost of the installation, you know, the budget for a venue, then... Craig is going to shop it to the institutions and contacts that he has. Oh, okay. He was the lead curator for Site Santa Fe, which is a major art institution in Santa Fe, New Mexico, as well as a curator at the Miami Art Museum. And I think the University of Minnesota. So he has connections in university venues and museum world and sort of art institution, not-for-profit art institutions.
Yeah.
So his idea is to, you know, shop it to his network. And it's a, I think it's, you know, it's a topic that would draw interest from these types of venues.
Yeah.
But what happened is, to fully realize the vision, I ran into needing to acquire quite a bit of technology, which gets very expensive very quickly, especially since what I wanted to do with it needed a lot of custom programming to pull off correctly. So then what happens is, well, describing the one last piece I want to build is like a life-size whistle. And inside the slot where the sound comes out, if you blow in a whistle, there's a little shelf with a series of red buttons that say something like, push me if you dare.
You know?
And I have found this really amazing speaker that was just released on from a crowdfunding effort that is a unidirectional speaker.
Okay.
So if it's pointed right at you like this, you hear the sound. But if it's just like that, that much off, you don't hear anything.
Oh, crazy.
The sound is unidirectional. It's very focused. And then outside of that, there's no sound. I don't know, quite understand. They have a great description of how it works, but it compresses the sound waves in a very narrow beam.
Yeah.
And so my idea is to install it on the ceiling directly over where somebody would stand in front of the whistle and install bullet mics around the installation in front of some of these bigger pieces that would invariably spark some conversations so that the person pushing those buttons suddenly hears the conversations going on in the room in front of other pieces. And so they become sort of an active surveiller of, the fellows in the room.
It's like
out in the open, but nobody else knowing, unless
Well, I was going to say, you know what it reminds me of? If you've been to the Exploratorium in San Francisco, is that those two seats that are across the entire room from each other?
Right.
And they have this kind of
parabolic thing
parabolic.
You can talk to each other like in a whisper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like that, which is one of the.
Except for one way,
Yeah.
And then, And then the other thing I want to do is install surveillance cameras throughout the installation. You know, people will see them. You just walk in and there's surveillance cameras all around. Yeah. And
well, we're used to that now.
Right, right. So that's one thing. But then the idea is to have almost like a separate space or on the wall that you enter behind so you don't see them at first. To have two large video walls where one is displaying the live video feed from each camera. And then on the other one, it would be displaying a ticker taping series of still images that would sort of bump each other through the screens until they fall off of images that are generated on emotion and time interval triggers so that there's only images being captured when people are there, not a bunch of empty space. And then the thing is, people will turn around and see that, okay, I'm actively being surveilled in here, you know, and then they discover they're being listened to as well, the whistle piece. And then the thing that really pushes it to the next level is that all of this is fed in near real time to a live website.
Okay.
So, anywhere in the world, people can observe the people in the installation. And then it takes it a step further by commodifying all the still images. So all the still images automatically go into, the website gallery of images, and they're all available for purchase, either as a print or a print product, like a t-shirt or a coffee mug. And, of course, in the entry to the installation, there's a sort of the entry wall statement, and written into it is some language that essentially says, by entering this installation, you completely consent to have your likeness recorded and used to the full extent of the purposes of the installation. And also, as fine art, you are legally allowed to take pictures of people and sell prints,
mm-hmm.
you know, just not for commercial purpose. You can't promote any commercial products. So, you know, this is, I've done my research there on the legal side, but the idea is that people come in, you know, if they bother to read all the small print, you know, or the full statement or not, they've passed the entry point into the installation and the disclaimer is there first things first. And so then their likeness is recorded, captured, and broadcast and commodified
mm-hmm.
without any further say.
This is like when you sign it for Facebook or iTunes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's, you know, not nearly as devious as Facebook. I mean, Facebook basically says we own a copy of your, any image you upload, and we can use it for any purpose we want, including licensing.
And you certainly can't get a copy of it when you want to find it.
Right, right.
Because they don't employ a search engine for you to look at your stuff or any way to.
Yeah.
Isn't it when they throw those memories back at you, right? They say, remember this? I'm like, oh, yeah, where did you have that photo?
Well, and some of them aren't even yours. You know, there are other people people might have, you know, posted or uploaded.
They tag. So. Yeah, they start to tag you now in things before.
Well, there was some really funny one where my wife got a, do you remember when, you know, you became friends with, like, Saul Hill, i.e. your husband.
Yeah.
But they didn't say, do you remember when you became friends with Saul Hill? And they were showing these like absurd pictures. And some of them I wasn't even in, you know, like somebody labeled a face wrong, you know, and where you can go in and write like who it is.
Or people tag you in just objects because they want you to be and they want you to see their post. Yeah.
There was one there like that too. So it was just hysterical. Like, one of them somehow, I think, was her cousin. You know, but I was tagged as her cousin. So showing a picture of her cousin and saying it was me.
You know, it makes me think that the government shouldn't employ artists because given a chance to run with it, an artist will come up with something way more devious than their engineers or their programmers will.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think anything is more devious than, you know, installing splitters that basically take all of AT&T's traffic or, you know, Verizon's traffic or Apple's traffic to, you know, these giant recording databases where they just record all the traffic going through, you know, without telling anyone. That's pretty devious.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, there are reasons, you know, to be vigilant online. Another thing that, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen it. You should check out the Norse threat map. And just Google that. Okay. It's a company called Norse that, and it's Norse something else.
It's not about Norwegians.
No, it's just,
no. Okay.
You know, the name of the company. But they deal with real-time threat protection for cyber attacks and stuff like that. And they have on their website, sort of as a demonstration why it's important, really important to have this, a real-time map of all the cyber attacks that are going on Earth, you know, that are being picked up by, you know, their and other security algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
And it's astonishing to look at. I mean, it looks like, it kind of looks like, what was that movie from the 80s?
War Games.
War Games, exactly.
Oh, good guess.
You know, and it kind of looks like... exactly that, you know, like thermonuclear Armageddon.
They're all coming in. They're all,
Oh my gosh. It's really kind of astonishing. So there's a reason. And, you know, I'm looking into seeing if I can just broadcast that in real time, you know, on a large screen in the installation. That's something I think would be useful to contextualize it. Mm. You know, yes, we have privacy. And yes, you know, there are reasons why, you know, but where do we think that we should have a degree of right to privacy.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things is that the technology has changed people's understanding of what privacy is, that we've given up a lot of our privacy and our understanding of it, especially for a younger generation. There seems to be no concept or worry that they shouldn't be sharing something.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because what I have discovered, you know, in some of the trial setups of the project is like, it's a very fascinating sort of study of the generational gaps, the transition from people that grew up prior to, you know, selfies and the ubiquitousness of being, you know, having a digital presence online. What I noticed, and it's not 100%, but in terms of trends, broad trends, you know, the older people that go through the installation tend to be more furtive. You know, they don't like the cameras up there. They kind of like shy away from them, look the other way, pull their hat down, or, you know, like give it a dirty look or something. And, you know, you can see some degree of physical discomfort in their bodies and their expressions in the installation. And then you get like teenagers or college students, younger generation, like the very plugged in generation now going through and literally like having conversations with cameras on the walls, you know, it could be like smiling and waving or grabbing your girlfriend and making out in front of the camera and like looking at the camera, making out with your girlfriend, looking at the screen, you know, having this sort of triad between the camera, the screen and the act, you know, very exhibitionist, to flipping off the camera or doing obscene and lewd gestures and, you know, screaming at the camera, you know, you want to look at me, look at this, you know, and just hysterical. And then sort of shades in between, you know, and it's almost the shades in between are almost like, what decade, you know, did you grow up in? And that's a really fascinating thing, because it kind of talks a little bit about, you know, the people that grew up where privacy was real. You know, it wasn't not, see, nowadays, and part of the reason I chose the title Suspicious Privacy is because if you unplug, if you pay in cash, if you live your life in a way where you're not easily tracked, you are sort of automatically lifted in, you know, the surveillance state's threat level.
Yeah.
And if you live a life where you're not easily tracked, you become more suspicious.
Why is that guy off the grid?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, you know, and then there's, you know, the young generation that they're just, it's all sort of entertainment, and they're going to interact with it in a way that is entertainment. And then you get the bandied about statement that if you have nothing to hide, you know, then what's it to you?
Yeah.
And so I don't really necessarily want to answer these questions. I'm trying to set up a situation where people viscerally feel what it is like to, you know, look at the keys of surveillance, the government GPS documents, the tracking keywords, the, you know, the audible whistle thing, which is sort of reference to where does the whistleblower fit into all of this. You know, it is a valuable part of our society. And yet almost most under attack, like the rights of protecting a whistleblower, are really being taken down. So I guess the point that I wanted to do is create, you know, the sense of discomfort or not, you know, and have people
if you're 15, they seem to be comfortable.
Yeah. Well, and not all are, you know, I mean, like I said, I saw quite a few teenagers or young college students coming through and, you know, getting it deeply.
Yeah.
And then there's this other urge to play with the entertainment factor. So, you know, it's, I guess this is a project that, I mean, I have my own opinions about where our right to privacy should dwell. And I'm not necessarily trying to foist it and say, you know, government is evil. I actually kind of think the opposite. I think not quite in terms of red and blue, you know, dialogue values of Republican or Democrat, you know. I just think that the government is a tool, and it is. I mean, it's a fundamentally, absolutely necessary tool to regulate society and business and, you know, everything in between. So what I find more interesting is who's using the tool. Because I guarantee you, you know, the people that use it the most, and I say people because now they legally have peoplehood, you know, are moneyed interests. You know, the more you have at stake, the more you actually want to use the tools to your benefit that exist. And the biggest tool around is the government. So, you know, this myth that flies around that government is evil, you know, I think is absolutely patently wrong.
Yeah, it's also incredibly simplistic.
It's incredibly simplistic. And I think that, you know, the myth that goes around that the government is great, it's, you know, I mean, it is necessary, but, you know, we're going to solve our problems all through government is also simplistic and wrong. Mm. You know, I think you just need to drill down to see who's using the tool, and it almost always goes to money.
Yeah. Do you know one of the interesting things of last week was when Ecuador cut off Julian Assange's access because they saw, and Ecuador probably did it because they got leaned on by the United States government, but because they felt that they were trying to influence the election through, and Russia was using Julian Assange. It's interesting how WikiLeaks has changed over the, this election has changed in my mind. I'm sure in many people's minds what WikiLeaks is, because at first it seemed to be very anti-authority and was operating just as this entity. But it seems to have been so taken in by Russia. So, and not even hidden, you know, it just seems so obvious that Russia is using WikiLeaks to try to not get Clinton in power.
Well, and again,
which is so weird to me, right? They've changed.
So he's holed up in an embassy.
Yeah.
You know, because like I said, you know, whistleblowers are now like prime targets. They want to use every power of, you know, the Patriot Act, of stuff that is designed to deal with terrorists and really dangerous people. They're using all those powers to target whistleblowers nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit of a tricky thing. I don't, you know, I don't want to necessarily defend Julian Assange or WikiLeaks or, you know, glorify them. But I do think that whistleblowers are crucial in democratic societies, especially the more you tend towards the march of consolidating power, very incredibly strong powers, and controlling information. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a country where 95% of all of our media is owned by a handful of corporations, we have very centralized and very controlled, you know, flows of information. So in this context, if you really actually care about, when you really target whistleblowers with all these tools, you know, then they're just trying not to be like, I don't know. I think there's sort of a reason why Russia has sort of opened their arms to Western whistleblowers and given them, you know, refuge or fed them information. It's unfortunate, you know, and it's unfortunate that there aren't more, you know, Russian whistleblowers. Of course, they're probably all jailed.
They're probably all dead
before they get a chance to blow the whistle.
I look at Edward Snowden on, they seem to be kind of opposites of each other. There's Assange and Snowden.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say they're polar opposites, but one points out, just by existing, one kind of points out the deficiencies in the other, because they kind of came up at the same time, or at least it feels that way.
I think WikiLeaks had been sort of public and active prior to, and probably, you know, I think, you know, it may have been part of the inspiration for him to, like, actually say, okay, I gotta come forward.
Yeah. But now their releases just seem to be timed as just any other political campaign. They're not just some random element dropping emails.
But almost survives, they have to, you know, if they're under such an immense threat and they know they've got, information, or they're being fed more and more information. Like, one thing you do to, you know, protect yourself is say, don't come after me or I'm going to dump this, you know. It's somewhat unfortunate. I think the situation is exasperated by the targeting of whistleblowers. You know, so it has gotten to this very unfortunate degree of, like, almost conflict, you know. And at the same time, cyber warfare, you know, and cyber attacks and the need to protect and lock down and secure information, you know, is super important. And that's part of the point of all of this. Like, here's my fundamental question with this project, is as our identity is being recorded into immense databases. And these databases are sharing information and sort of compiling an amalgamation of who we are online. Mm. At what point, you know, let me phrase my question properly. Mm. You know, what happens when our identities are being defined by others online? You know, how accurate are they? You know, how do we let ourselves be defined? And because then the world will respond to us by the information it is compiled without our knowledge.
Yeah. And you may unknowingly change your own personality because of what's being fed back to you. It becomes a loop.
A bit of a loop, yeah.
I want to go back to Craig, who helped you get into this project. Is this a typical for him? Is this the typical of your relationship with him, for him to suggest something like this? Because this seems like either he saw something in you and decided, okay, photos are not enough. You got to do something bigger.
Well,
were you surprised by that when he...
I was a little bit surprised, mostly because, like I said, I had no experience in installation art. And so I was definitely schooled and, you know, kind of taught like how to expand the thought of, you know, dealing with the topic, not necessarily just in a one-dimensional, you know, plane, you know, how to set up an experience, you know, that can be, we talked a lot about visceral, how to make something visceral, how to make it, have presence. And I mean, presence is one of these things bandied around in the art world that is, kind of all important. And at the same time, very difficult to pin down, you know, what gives something, you know, presence where it like commands attention, where it comes at you at different ways and engages different parts of you, you know, that you might not necessarily understand all at once. So it's engaging, you know, it gives it that presence. So we had lots of discussions about that. I don't think he really suggested anything that I should do. You know, you should do this. I would talk about things. Like, I remember when he said that, I had said, oh yeah, you know, there's this government document that, you know, that was released that it was about GPS surveillance where like 108 of 111 pages are totally redacted. You know, I mean, I could turn that into a light box. You know, it was him throwing sort of ideas about talking about, turning something into a three-dimensional experience with different, you know, and he was even sort of suggesting maybe finding things that are not necessarily photographs, you know, but my background is predominantly photographic in one degree or another, whether it's a metagraph or, you know, and the installation is in one degree or another, largely photo related. There's photo copies. Mm-hmm. There's actual photographs of computer screens. There's blow ups of other photocopies. And then there's digital image projection, you know, on the screen and online and video. So, you know, it still relates largely to photo, video, you know, technology, and presentation of information, but it's not all, you know, there are sort of sculptural objects. There's that immersive thing with the live feedback and, both physically in place and then virtually, you know, in cyberspace.
Do you think this is a detour for where your career is, a new avenue? Are you going to go back to the metagraphs? How do you place this in your career?
I think it's the start of another direction because I have a series of installation type concepts that I want to work on. This is the one that is the hardest because it's so much moving parts of the technology, you know, the cameras that can achieve all the things they need to achieve, the, you know, the getting it onto the screens, you know, in kind of in real time, but also then in real time streaming to a website, which automatically without somebody having to choose or apply, you know, the commerce options or upload the images just to automate it all so that it all goes online. And the images are automatically populated with e-commerce capabilities. And at the same time, you know, I have don't have it yet, but it's all lined up, the equipment, an on-site event printer, where I want to have an iPad kiosk in the space, which is where people will see that this is all streaming online. They can interact with the website online as well. And we're playing around, the programmer and I have been bandying ideas back and forth. One is to have, when you go to the website, you know, the browser pop up and say, you know, this site is best, the interactive features of this site are best experienced if you enable the camera on your device. Mm. And if they do, it automatically takes a picture of the visitor and then overlays like all the data that, you know, usually you can get that websites track, like, you know, the browser, the operating system, the time, the date, the location, the IP address, you know, all this sort of readily available information, but just visualizing it and having it populate like as an overlay over the image, and then drop the image into the photo library. So the you know, the idea is then to make these sort of recursive things where you get people in the installation interacting with it online, you know, and going back and looking at all the pictures and like, oh, they're here, you know, and maybe even buying a print that they can either, you know, get one just like pay on pay right there and get a printout at the event printer, or, you know, order a t-shirt or a print to be, you know, sent home on the site. And then of course anyone in the world can order a print or a print product of anyone else who went through. So think of all those like great people that are just like exhibitionistically interacting with the cameras.
Yeah.
You know, flipping off the cameras and yelling at it or doing lewd gestures or making out with their girlfriends or boyfriends. You know, those could all potentially be great, like just fantastic t-shirts.
Have you run through a...
I'm trying to decide whether or not to run like a same overlay or random overlays, you know, that say something like suspicious in a big red stamp, you know, over the image.
Yeah. I was going to say, have you thought of the worst case scenario for this? The abuse that could come through.
Oh, back this? To me?
Yeah.
Well, you know, if,
or just through the what you could do with this installation.
I think the abuse is, you know, I'm get targeted by, you know, NSA or whatever. It'd be,
you may be already, man.
I mean, we all are to a certain degree. So having to put that aside as a, and so what, you know, what am I going to do about that?
Yeah.
The main thing is I need to be pretty clear on how much transmission I can do of images, and be very careful that it isn't, you know, plugging any particular product. I do want to do some fundraising to complete this, and my preferred way is to do a crowdfunding campaign, which I've been working towards completing. I'm just trying to find an individual that is experienced in the issues of electronic privacy, electronic surveillance, electronic, you know, kind of a good talking head. I wanted to try to get somebody like Glenn Greenwald, you know, the reporter who, along with Laura Poitras, broke the Snowden story, just to speak briefly in favor of the project for the crowdfunding campaign. Mm-hmm. And I've tried a number of different people, you know, Bill Moyers. I haven't been able to get through anybody's firewalls, you know, and this is maybe because it's a tricky subject and they don't know who I am.
They got some words are getting flagged.
Right. Yes. So I'm trying to work on that. I've got myself as a speaker, a fantastic sort of critic and arts writer and editor down in LA, who's going to speak in favor. And of course, Craig, the editor. I just wanted to find somebody in the realm of, you know, having institutional knowledge or name recognition that, you know, has reported or works on. Right. So the other idea was to try to reach out to the ACLU and, you know, get somebody who from the ACLU to speak about it, or maybe the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which does a ton of stuff around this kind of work. So as soon as I get that together, I think I'll have the crowdfunding campaign ready to launch.
All right.
And after that, I've got my sights set on 2-3 other installation concepts. And it's just sort of an issue of, you know, which one, one to go running with.
Yeah.
One of them has to do with gun violence, which was inspired by my reactions to the shooting at UCSB a couple years ago. And I, you know, as an artist, I think going back to your question of like, where do I fit between sort of the aesthetic work of the Metagraphs and this more topical work, I think I was questioning myself as an artist, you know, how do I speak to the contemporary age? You know, yes, I love doing this work. I love the visual aesthetics and sense and, you know, of the Metagraph work that we talked about last time. And then I felt like, but I have a responsibility as an artist to speak. And this is timeless and contemporary at the same time. But what do I do about the contemporary topical issues?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think artists have an amazing ability to look at issues and present them in ways that, that touch people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, done well. Ideally, this is something where, you know, you create an experience. And I have also had some experience working with a foundation in the past that did a lot of, I guess I would say, progressive work on issue areas. And they migrated around a little bit on some of the topics that they were working on, anywhere from water issues in the West to that was older. To women's health and reproductive issues, to you know, voting issues, and coalition building. Then they ended up focusing that project in Colorado, to in conjunction with other sort of state sort of grassroots issues.
Yeah,
and I was always in awe of these people that work on sort of the front line of. Of issues.
You said always, so that must have been something that you experienced growing up or
well, college. A little bit. I mean, not so much my parents. My parents were artists and my dad an educator. But I think, you know, I was had some friends that were activists growing, my parents did, that were activists growing up. I remember when I was in college in Portland, Oregon, in the Pacific Northwest, during the time that like the spotted owl was a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember, you know, sort of researching sort of the failures of the environmentalist movement, of which I would say I was square in the middle of, like totally, you know, look, you know, yeah, we need an economy, but we also need an environment, and we need to respect, you know, the other lives that inhabit the earth, not just the human ones. But what I discovered in the Northwest was just this immense chasm between reality and the movement.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a chasm that was sort of fostered by greenwashing and the lack of engagement of anybody from the environmentalist movement, which was predominantly urban, you know, onto foisting the narrative onto the rural areas that were actually sort of suffering cutbacks in timber industry.
This goes back to our
initial
right at the beginning.
But the example here is that people weren't losing jobs because, you know, of environmental regulations restricting, you know, timber activity, you know, which the spotted owl became the symbol. And everyone in the rural areas in Oregon wanted to kill all the spotted owls.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone in the urban areas was saying how stupid and selfish the people in the rural, it was so ugly. And it was like needless. What was really going on at the time is two things. Most of the large raw logs, timber coming out of the Northwest at the time were being shipped off to Japan. Whole, intact, you know, and most of that was sunk, you know, offshore for the future. Jeff, you know, big investors investing in wood for the future when there's no more wood.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't, or they were processing it there. So all of the processing plants, the, you know, making the mills and the, all that were not getting the work that would have gone to making the wood products. Well, the other thing was that the mills and most of the timber companies were automating.
Mm-hmm.
So there were fewer jobs due to automation, and they would tell everyone, oh, it's because, you know, we of the regulations. And so this narrative, you know, sort of, it was sort of a greenwashing and a somewhat arrogant indifference in the, you know, urban environmental movement, greenwashing from industry, and it turned into a cultural battle.
Mm.
And I mean, I was just like, I was so immensely frustrated with all of that, and had my own little battles too. You know, my grandmother was, her parents or her grandparents had invested in Weyerhaeuser and Boise Cascade, and you know, that was, she would remind me, that's some of the money that is paying for your education, so you should be, you know, more respectful. And I said, look, because of that, I have to be more, you know, realistic about, you know, what's going on. I don't think that it's all bad. We need wood, but we don't need to be making toilet paper out of old growth trees.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry, you know, there's better things to make paper out of. But the other thing is the amount of government subsidy that goes into the timber industry was astonishing. You know, I mean, it was just absolutely astonishing. Between the tax breaks, the road building, the all the incentives, you know, and all of that, it was at least at the time. I've fallen probably a good decade or more behind in my research, and but at the time, it was almost the most subsidized industry in the country. I mean, and then we go back to money and politics and all of that. And, you know, anybody who complains about the welfare state, I'd say, okay, so are we going to look at, you know, corporate or business welfare as well? Or are you only talking about social welfare? Because the government spends more money on corporate welfare, you know, than we do on social welfare by far.
Well, one of the things that the powers that be are very good at is creating narratives, and not just powers that be, but as you're pointing out, the environmental movement created a narrative that was false to get people excited.
Totally erroneous,
and the logging industry did the same thing. So this is a battle of two false narratives, and somewhere in the middle lies this complicated, ambiguous truth, really hard for us to get.
Now we get the same thing going on, going back to my next project that I want to work on, gun violence, and my reaction to the shooting at UCSB. You know, the narratives around guns in this country are like, it's just incredible, you know, and immense passion on all sides. But at the same time, a lot of the immense passion on the pro-gun side is tied to business model, you know, somebody's profit making, you know, and guns and weapons are, you know, enormously profitable. I mean, it's just, and the incentive, you know, every business is in business to make money, to make profit. That is the way our society is regulated. And the question I have is it okay for businesses to be unregulated in their process of making profit? Because if the process of making that profit is harming people, is that okay? You know, will they self-regulate? No, I think not always. The profit motive often dominates. So then you do need an outside force to say, we need some reasonable limits on, you know, how you're profiting.
Yeah.
Profit is fine, you know, as long as it's not harming more than it is, you know, benefiting.
Yeah. There's no way any company will self-regulate.
No.
That's just an absurd thought. I can't believe that there's an example of any company along the way, whatever it may, it doesn't have to be something controversial like guns, it could be anything.
Right.
Where they stepped in and said, you know, really, really should try to regulate this more.
It took an immense amount of activist effort to get, you know, computer manufacturers, to get Apple, for example, to, you know, deal with recycling and downstream waste. And even now, that's not sufficiently dealt with.
Or cars that have seatbelts.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, cars that have seatbelts. I mean,
right? That's not just like some kooky feature.
Right.
But like, oh, hey, maybe
but
we should
that took
do this.
A lot of fight.
Yeah, it took a huge, huge fight to get it.
So, you know, but going to the gun violence project, I wanted to take a little bit of a different approach towards it. And I don't think I want to speak in terms of the specifics of how I want to, you know, present it until I'm kind of close to it being done. But the mm-hmm. idea that I really wanted to do with more was the human experience, you know, again, kind of through the photographic, the video, memory in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But then make it in a way that without necessarily having the gun in place, you know, the connection just so viscerally, again, this is a project that the intention is to make, you know, an intriguing thing, you know, very intriguing visual experience become a sudden, like, punch in the gut emotionally. And I'm very excited about that project. Of course, it's always topical. I keep getting frustrated because I want to move on to it with such urgency because there's always like the most yeah. horrific thing that just happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have to remind myself, damn, if I miss this, you know, horrific event,
yeah,
there'll be one next
there'll
week.
There'll be another one. There'll be another match.
But here. What I want to do with that project yeah. is fundraise, not so much to build it because yeah. it's not nearly as expensive. I want to fundraise to allow that project to travel to communities that have experienced. If somebody in that community says, I would like to bring this installation here and I've got a location for it, mm-hmm. I would like to be able to say, okay, I'm sending it
mm-hmm.
without them having to pay. You know,
mm-hmm.
I've got the transportation, the installation, and my creative fee covered by these grants or these donations.
Yeah.
So my idea is to make it something that would be kind of like a public, part of the public process mm-hmm. of coping, reconciling, you know, the loss of a mass shooting.
Mm.
Because fundamentally we're talking about real people, you know, actual lives, human people, not concepts, not the right to bear arms or, you know, the industry's incentive to maintain their business model or government regulation. We're talking about, you know, us. And that's sort of the point of that. I'm very excited to move on to that. Then I have a
now we're talking about 2020, yeah. 2021.
Then I have one that's just sort of almost more like an internet prank in a way, but yeah. from an artist perspective,
uh-huh.
Where I want to re-engineer the whole concept of like user agreements, you know, every bank account, every credit card, every software you install, everything nowadays has these, you know, ubiquitous, you know,
huge contract that we just click on,
that you just click yes and move on,
yeah.
you know, or you sign a box or you know, it says somewhere in there, like, you know, by applying for this, you agree to, you know, blah, 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 which spells out, you know, I want to sort of reverse engineer that and create an absurdly long and legally sound, but humorously written, consumer agreement posted online with a tiny URL.
Okay.
You know, so that anybody can just write it onto their check or, you know.
Oh, I see.
And kind of play with that reverse engineering. I think the artistic side of it would be something more like a curation of correspondence and reactions that people send in,
you know, yeah.
to create a book or a space around that. But yeah, it's...
really far from photographs.
That one's yeah. straying much further.
Yeah. Last question, since we were talking about contrasting narratives. Are there some interesting narratives that you find Santa Barbara tells itself?
Oh. I get myself in trouble here a little bit. I love Santa Barbara. It's one of the most pleasant places to live. It's a great place to have a kid. As an artist, I often get frustrated here. And mind you, I came here from Santa Fe, New Mexico,
mm-hmm.
which is like an almost absurdly cosmopolitan, you know, broad, diverse viewpoint, international, little, tiny city, you know, mm-hmm. smaller than Santa Barbara. But people there are so much more engaged in such a wide, you know, array of issues, whether they're political, you know, social justice or environmental or artistic or spiritual,
mm-hmm.
you know, that when I came here, and I just be frank, mm-hmm. I kind of felt that Santa Barbara was a textbook definition of a not in my backyard kind of mentality. We like to think about things if it's the oil spill that affects us, mm-hmm. you know, or, you know, what's going on here, you know, and it's a weird thing because there are more not-profit organizations in Santa Barbara than there are almost anywhere else. And a lot of them are doing fantastic work on a huge variety of things. And then there's UCSB and there's City College and there's, you know, Antioch and there's all these higher education, you know, facilities here. But kind of in daily life on the street, I feel like people don't really talk much about the big issues. And
why is that? Is this because it's so nice? Is it just
Is it because the weather is so great and the food's so good and the farmers markets are so alluring and the, you know, the surf is up and, you know, or the wind is up and you can go sailing or, you know, I'm not entirely sure if that's always, if that's all that it is or not.
There's something where anytime I'm at one of these events and someone says, Santa Barbara cares about whatever. Santa Barbara loves the arts. There's always a part of me going, but does it? Or like when I hear like Santa Barbara loves film and I'm like, but do we? Like, there's always the question that comes back.
Well, I think that there are a lot of well-educated, interesting people in Santa Barbara with a lot of diverse backgrounds. And so there are people that have all these interests, but somehow like culturally as a city, it doesn't always come through. And, you know, I'm not really sure that Santa Barbarans love the arts. Mm-hmm. But as a city, Santa Barbara is not it's a difficult place to be an artist and actually sell work. And I wonder why, you know, I think that what does well here are sort of the plein air, very vibrant and active and some great plein air paintings. But in terms of contemporary art, it's a real struggle. Mm-hmm. And I've had some really interesting discussions with people because, you know, if you go to Palm Springs, which is similar size population and a similar distance from Los Angeles.
Also a tourist destination.
And also a tourist destination.
Also a place to retire.
Also a place to retire. There's a lot of similarities. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have ocean and desert, you know, are the two big differences. But the other big difference is the architectural style. You have here, you know, this colonial Spanish style as an architectural style. And there, you know, was a modernist, you know, architectural style for a long time, one of the sort of
mid-century modern. Yes.
And it continues, you know, that's a predominant sort of architectural style. And I think architecturally these styles lend themselves on the one hand to, you know, large modern or contemporary works and here, to more historic, or plein air or, you know, kind of that coastal plein air of look.
Yeah.
And, you know, it may not be that the walls are as big. There's more architectural detailing here in terms of the Spanish style. So, you know, is that the main reason? You know, I in terms of affluence, in terms of proximity to LA and size of population and destination and all those things that, you know, identified, they're very similar.
Mm-hmm.
There's just this very different, you know, sort of architectural. So it's an interesting thought to think about. Maybe part of it is, you know, the predominant architectural aesthetic of the city.
Never thought of that, but that's interesting. Does the architecture of a city
affect
the arts?
The arts that it supports.
That's a thinker. And it gets back to what we talked about in the first interview, in part one of this, where I was saying I found it hard to say, look, I'm an American, or I'm a Californian, or I'm a Santa Barbaran, because my version of that is completely different from someone else, just for Santa Barbara. If we think about the arts community, like, I feel like, yes, I'm part of the arts community, but are we Santa Barbarans?
The arts community?
We're a subsection of Santa Barbara's, but do we have a grasp of what Santa Barbara wants? I feel like the artists in Santa Barbara are often asking, what does Santa Barbara want? Even though we are Santa Barbara's, but we're artists within it. Mm-hmm. But we have that same question, which is, what is our city about? What do we want? What do they want?
Well, it's an interesting thing because there are a lot of art collectors here.
Yes.
You know, and we've got two of the most affluent, you know, sort of communities on the continent, between Montecito and Hope Ranch and outside of that, I mean, just around the general area, there are still people that love the arts and collect.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost like unless they're looking for that coastal historic or plein air painting, you know, thing, there's no prestige in buying local contemporary art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to go to LA for that, or New York, or Berlin, or Paris, or, you know, Tokyo or London. You know, you want to go to the centers. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like the march that has been happening throughout society, but is equally visible in the art world towards the 1%. You know, in the art world, and it's not in Santa Barbara, it's just generally speaking going on in the art world. The art world, even through, you know, the depression, 2008 and on, the art world was almost doing better than it ever had done before in terms of total sales.
Mm-hmm.
But almost all of that were in sort of the blue chip names of super famous artists, mm-hmm. Being bought by, you know, the 1%. So it was the 1% of artists that were selling to the 1%, or even the 1% of the 1%.
Yeah.
And at these very high levels, I mean, some of the biggest records ever were being, you know, made in terms of the most expensive photograph ever sold, you know, for $4 million and change. I've forgotten what it, mm-hmm. you know, and the most expensive painting ever sold. Well, there's another one that sold that was more, but I remember when Pollock's painting sold for $163 million or something.
Yeah.
It's just like these stratospheric levels. And it's almost like in the collecting world, you know, to impress your collecting friends, you don't want to get local art because there's no prestige. You want to go, you know, to the big name, you know, mm-hmm. gallery that just opened and get that big name artist. So it's sort of like a mirroring of this is why I think art actually is so interesting. It's like this always sort of like a distilling of what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. And that is an economic trend going on in the world, and it's being mirrored in the art world.
Mm.
So when you ask me, does Santa Barbara support the arts? I mean, you could answer it politically. You know, what is the city doing for the arts?
Mm-hmm.
Or you could just look at it as a community. Do Santa Barbarans, you know, actually love the arts? Well, if they did, they would buy from local artists if they loved our art scene.
Yeah.
And I would argue that most of the local artists here, you know, would like more local patrons. I've sold more work out of my studio here to New Yorkers than anywhere else.
Hmm.
And it's just randomly that, you know, I've had a small string of New Yorkers walk in. You know?
And that's how you're selling. People walking in the city from...
Right. Yeah.
Because they're tourists.
Because they're tourists.
Yeah.
So that was a real surprise to me. I was like thinking, okay, I've got to advertise, like target New Yorkers visiting Santa Barbara. Like, how do I do that? You know, I'm sure there's a Facebook algorithm, but
yeah.
But anyway, so, boy, I hope I don't get myself in too much trouble for my frank opinions.
Well, we didn't name names. We didn't, you know, it's all because of so-and-so.
So I think that I did an artist residency at the Torpedo Factory in Alexandria, Virginia, right across the river from Washington, D.C., summer before last. And I was there for a full month,
mm-hmm.
and it was a really fantastic experience. I mean, the Torpedo Factory is this big old building that was a torpedo factory.
Actually was a torpedo factory. Okay.
And then it was derelict and empty for a while. And it's sort of right downtown Alexandria. And I think it was in the late 60s, early 70s, they did this movement to turn it into an art cluster,
mm-hmm.
of studios for subsidized studios for artists.
Yeah.
And so then it became, you know, it's three floors and there's something like 83 studios or something. So it's a big thing, you know, I mean, it'd be hard to find a building like that around here, but it became a nexus of working artists, and the public can walk all through the building and visit the studios, look into the studios, and, you know, there's a ton of art to look at. They can interact with working artists, or the working artists can close their door, and but they're all like glass windows looking into each studio. So there's always sort of presentation, display space, and it kind of is a tourist draw. And then along the way, that whole corridor of downtown Alexandria developed into this awesome strip. I think it's King Street, of restaurants and shops and bars, and it's a tourist destination, and you know, in no small part to this big destination, you know, working studio artist cluster. And I was thinking, like, if the city here really wanted to support the arts, you start by supporting artists. And, you know, a project that would be fantastic for Santa Barbara would be something similar.
Yeah.
You know, but it would have to be, because most of the time, like, rent goes up here. And artists are always rent sensitive because we need space, you know. And, but as an artist, I mean, you lose money for years until you build up enough clientele, you know, to support yourself. So it's like the normal business model of becoming an artist is inverted. You know, it's a difficult thing to do. It takes a ton of, and people, I get a little frustrated when time when people ask me what I do and I say I'm an artist and they're like, oh, yeah. Like as if that's no work or.
Oh, you're just having fun.
Or you're just having fun. Yeah. And it's like, so anybody who is an entrepreneur and works for themselves knows it's no easy thing. Mm-hmm. And it's not even easy if you are making cabinets or, you know, doing things that people need all the time, you know, that there's always a demand for something.
Yeah.
But if you're an artist where you're making something, you know, you're reaching in and finding something to express and you're expressing it, and there's not a clear outside market, like, you know, I need to have a blurry, pixelated, grainy, mysterious picture of a cloud-like formation of a human figure.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's something that is more like you have to experience it first. It speaks to you, but you don't go out of your way necessarily saying, oh, I need to buy, you know, an intriguing piece of art today. Like you do, I need to buy a bagel sandwich for lunch. So it's a cultural thing. You know, there are like places like New York where it is culturally, and Europe, you know, a culture, a lot throughout Europe. I have a friend who, even though he moved to LA, he's a Czech artist, but, and his wife is French and they lived in France for many, 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 many years. Even though they've moved to LA, he's kept his small little art studio slash gallery in a tourist town in the south of France that he goes back to at spring break and summer. And he sells more there than he sells.
Oh, really?
You know, through almost the rest of the year. He sells more there in like 3 months of the year than he sells anywhere else. You know, because culturally Europeans deeply appreciate art and they make space for it in their lives. They budget for it. And, and I think you see a little more of that in the East Coast. I think Californians, West Coast, we love art. We love design. We love things that look good, but care less if it's handmade or if it's, you know, imported from China. It's a weird East Coast, West Coast kind of thing. But we love design. We love cool stuff here.
Oh, yeah, we do.
But I noticed that when I had my previous business, we designed and manufactured natural stone and twig and handmade paper lamps and lighting fixtures and ultimately twig-legged, stone-topped or wood-topped tables with stone inlay. And it was always easier to sell in the East Coast than it was when we came to the West Coast shows.
Yeah.
And that we're in this realm of sort of high-end craft furnishings, you know, just a dip below, you know, fine art. But it was that our genre was sort of like American craft and, you know, handmade, unique furniture type shows. And it was everybody could always see this schism between the East and the West.
Yeah. It's been that way for some time.
Yeah. 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 So, you know, I guess the conclusion is, you know, does the community support the arts? That's my question. You know, does the community support the arts here? Mm. You know, there's always a great turnout for the art walks. They're a lot of fun. But I can't rely as an artist on local business to stay afloat. So I have to spend a lot of time, you know, targeting, you know, my work to go out of town. Mm. And with all the shipping and travel expenses related, it's a harder thing. It'd be to, you know, eats into whatever sales I do have.
Mm. But you're here. You're here now.
I am
for
here.
The foreseeable future.
And I love Santa Barbara. I love putting up my work here. I like actually inhabiting the space that isn't, you know, so heavily filled, you know, doing more contemporary work. And albeit the aesthetic work is very much appreciated. It's just not in the genre of the plein air. I do actually have, you know, coastal, whole series of coastal and, you know, seascape metagraphs. How can you live here and not look at that all the time and do something with it?
So there's that. Yeah. All right. Well, Saul, I think we covered our bases, you think?
Pretty good.
Pretty good, huh? All right.
Well, I'm glad that you came back and we could discuss the installation projects I'm working on. And I appreciate it.
And the upcoming show.
And the upcoming,
Group show. All right. Thanks, man. Thanks for talking.
Great. Cheers. Good to see you again.
Oh, my goodness. There you have it, folks. That could have gone on to Volume 3, but we have other shows coming up. Saul Hill in conversation with me. He is at saulhill.com, SOLHILL.com. And for me, you can find me over at funkzonepodcast.com, where you should join the mailing list because, hey, I just announced the tickets at the beginning of the show, as you know, for our 100th episode extravaganza coming up in just a couple of weeks. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. I'm also on Twitter at Ted Mills and on Facebook at Funk Zone Podcast and on iTunes, where you should subscribe to us and give us a whole bunch of star ratings, and that will make us feel like we are loved. Okay, that's it for me. Now I'm gonna go, but I'm gonna leave you in the capable hands of my second grade friend, Joseph. Take it away, Joe. I'll see you later, folks. Bye-bye.
And now for a big goodbye. See you soon. We'll make some more tapes later on. Bye. We might make some more tapes later on. Bye. My big friend. More tapes later on. Yeah. See you soon. Bye.